broadcasting live from the Civic Media Studios in Green Bay. This is Nightlight with Pete Chwaba, your inside source on everything entertainment from Wisconsin to Hollywood. And now, a guy who once planted evidence so he could make a citizen's arrest, Pete Chwaba.
We are back for hour number two of Nightlight, broadcasting live statewide from Civic Media headquarters here in Madison. We'll be here the next couple nights. It is angry out there, ladies and gentlemen. Get somewhere where you feel safe, and a basement preferably. I don't know, Luke. I'm not. I do present a 5-day forecast every once in a while, but it's not very accurate. I don't know. What do you think? Is this?
There are warnings going out here. It doesn't give me a full coverage area, but yeah. The National Weather Service saying severe thunderstorm warnings. There's tornado warnings, destructive winds up to 80 mile an hour winds. Getting emergency alerts saying take shelter. So if you are in the area of South Central Wisconsin, be aware that you shouldn't be doing anything outside. Don't be playing.
It's not worth it.
Yeah, just don't worry about a last minute grocery run or anything along those lines. Take shelter. Be safe. Stay tuned to Civic Media. We'll give you updates throughout the evening. But you're gonna want to shelter and seek cover.
Word. And if you are up in the Wausau area, Civic Media meteorologist Brittany Merlot just sent out a tweet. I think it was a tweet or something on her Facebook page that said there was a tornado that touched down west of Wausau.
You don't tweet on Facebook pages, but yeah, if she's getting
out of Facebook, yeah, okay. I meant to say, or, I know they're two different things. I don't have a techno boob, but I get basic. Oh, these kids today, Maggie. I don't know.
These kids these days. Okay.
What are you going to do?
Can I nerd out and give a baseball update?
Yeah, sure.
So during the top of the hour news, weather, and sports, the Brewers went up by 7-5. Whoa. Inning started out with Bowers hitting a double. Blake Perkins grounded out. Bryce Turang popped out, so we were two outs. We had a Contreras walk. Yelly hit a triple, bringing in two runs. Adames hit a double, putting us up by two. So it is the bottom of the eighth inning. Brewers up 7-5 against the Miami Marlins.
Those are the innings you live for. Go ahead, Luke.
And you can listen to your Milwaukee Brewers on several different Civic Media stations around the state of Wisconsin.
But don't do that right now. You should stay put right here.
Listen to them on the radio signal and then on the Civic Media app. Right. Listen to the Nightlight. That way you get your evening entertainment and your baseball fix all at once.
That's why God created highlights.
All of the above. Yes.
That's right.
Or Maggie Dawn will just give you a sports update whenever something exciting happens.
I honestly think like I've reached a point in my life where I have to pick one sport to follow. As much as I love baseball as a kid, and I still love it, those are the innings you live for, like a rally, like that makes baseball worth it. It's like in soccer when they score a goal for the first time in three games. It's like exciting, and it takes you there. It's the best thing about the sport.
Yeah, two out run scoring in baseball is great. Stealing home yesterday by Yelich. I mean, that stuff is amazing. I've seen a walk-off grand slam. I absolutely love the game of baseball. Soccer, you can keep that.
The dramatics.
Stop like,
it.
Luke, I played rugby in college. I won a national championship crying out loud. Yeah.
You don't have to hate on any other sport, though. You can just let other sports enjoy themselves.
Like so many times in my life, I'm going to be the voice of reason here. And I'm just going to say, playing soccer is fun. I played Frisbee Ultimate, a little soccer in college. Soccer is fun to play, and it's fun to watch when everyone has their jerseys on at a bar and drinking Bloody Marys. Then I get into it. I'm never sitting at home watching a soccer game just for the sake of watching.
The World Cup. It's the World Cup. It's the world's game. Like it is the most popular game. Let's not just act like we're too good for it. Okay, it is the world's favorite game.
No, I'm fully gonna act like I'm too good for it. 100% in on it. That is boring.
Listen, just don't make him leave, Maggie. I need Luke for at least another hour here, and then I know he's going to storm out.
Yes, I'll wait promptly to 8:59 or 8:59 even, and then I will storm
out. You're going to lock me in here with the tornado on the way, and I've got no basement. Tom from 414 from New Berlin says, Maggie love. He loves that Maggie is here, and he says, Civic Media rocks. as it does. Jim from Appleton says, favorite card game is spades. Hours and hours of spades. I got to learn some of these card games. I feel very, I got to get with it.
If you know the basics of cards, you can fit like spades, hearts, sheep's head is complicated, euchre slash hearts slash spade. I mean, they're all highly related. We could teach Luke. I think we should teach Pete some euchre.
I could give him a crash course here.
It's pretty simple. Yeah.
It would be fun at the next Christmas party.
It's easy to learn, very hard to master is the big thing about euchre. Mm-hmm. You can pick up euchre in an afternoon or an evening, but it's going to take you some time to get good about actually strategically playing. And everybody plays differently with who their partner is too. So yes. I play a much different strategy when I play. I have my wife is very begrudgingly she's a last case scenario partner because she's just like, I don't get this
desperation partner.
Yeah, she's like, well, I have to convince her. I was just saying, I have to beg essentially because it's like, she's like, I don't get it. The jacks keep changing on me. This is weird. I don't like it.
Told her those are Bowers, right. Damn it. Those are Bowers.
So I play a completely different if she's my partner, but when we're with her family, her and our uncle and I are teammates, and it is phenomenal because just like the littlest quirks and stuff that you can pick up on. But my college buddy, I lived a summer in D.C., and we found as many people that we could convert to euchre players as we could, and then we would just run the table.
Midwest.
We would just run the table with all of them, and it was amazing. So it depends who you play with, too.
God, I lived in Wisconsin for 20 years, and I have to, not in a row, but two separate, I got to learn some of these games.
Yeah, you do. To be a proper Midwesterner, euchre is you. It's a box you got to check.
I'm on it. I'll get on it. My guest is Maggie Dawn of The Maggie Dawn Show. If you've not checked it out, check it out. It's here on the Civic Media Radio Network every single day. She does a great job. I want to ask you two quick questions, Maggie, and then I want to ask you what you're watching. Who's your favorite guest you've had on your show so far?
Wow. I just interviewed James Causey, who is an award-winning reporter for the Journal Sentinel, and I loved talking to him.
Nice.
I also interviewed one of the founding members of the Trans-Siberian Orchestra, and he's from Jersey and hung out in New York, and he was super cool. And I was a classically trained violinist, but played a lot of different kinds of, and we were able to kind of get in that place where you're just having a vibe with someone on live radio. And it was so fun. Both of those interviews for different reasons. I genuinely, at the end of the day, I really enjoy people and I'm curious, right? I'm curious about other people's experiences and trying to talk to folks about that and find these commonalities that we have, because somewhere there's something that we've got in common. And it's fun when you can have those little moments.
I am so with you. And I tell my kids that I'm like, I love seeking out people that know stuff that I don't know or that are great at something. All I want to do is talk to them and learn about how they got there and about something. I mean, conversation truly is an art. And, you know, you have to listen, you have to be a good listener, you have to have something to bring to the table, so to speak. So I am totally with you. That's a great answer. All right, last question for you before we let you get back to your game and Luke and I run to the basement. What are you watching on TV? What do you binge watch? Or are you cringe watching something that you're mad at yourself that you're sticking with it?
So I finally was able to break myself of the habit of the Housewives franchise on Bravo. Wow.
Good for you.
It took me a few years. I mean, I caught it when they first were coming out.
Okay.
And the women weren't yet aware of the fact that they were getting watched so much. Now there's this element of the fourth wall coming down and they're very much performing and sort of working for clicks, and it became really disingenuous at a certain level.
Yeah.
But I loved that beautiful mess when it started, and it didn't matter which one of the cities it was in.
Right.
So I've finally gotten off of that.
Okay.
I DVR Jeopardy every day.
Oh, nice.
Me too.
Luke, we're going to put Jeopardy on and play Euchre.
Play cribbage clearly. Or Euchre, yeah.
Play cribbage.
See, oh, but I then I'm going to get distracted from one or the other because then I'm going to be too focused on the Jeopardy questions.
That's her plan. What she wants, Luke.
Well, not if I'm her partner. She doesn't want me distracted if we're playing together. It depends.
We're clearly playing together. Yeah, we'll Jeopardy's 30 minutes. It's like 22 minutes.
Oh, we fast forward through all the commercials. I was just saying, we skip the commercials.
I've got a question for you, Luke. I'm sorry.
Hey, listen, can I get anybody some water? Or I just whipped up a quiche.
It's the Pete Schwab go check show. Nightlight.
Pete, I thought you wanted an easy lift today. We're
looking
over
out the window. Yeah. Keeping an eye on the storm.
So I have a question for you about your Jeopardy consumption, Luke. I do not like watching the Q&A between Ken Jennings. Nope, neither do I.
I never watched it.
Just get to the questions.
I miss Trebek dearly, but I would skip over Trebek's Q&A too. Unless I had heard that there was like a salty one that it was like good and it was kind of back and forth, then I'd go back and watch it. But skip right through all that. I'll get to know some of the contestants when they're around for, you know, 4 or 5 games if they're returning champions. Then I'll be interested to hear what their 2 cents is. But for the most part, just right through the bios. Yep.
Just give me the questions.
I want
just
the questions.
Go right
give
to the
me
categories.
The knowledge. Yep. I am seeking the knowledge of Jeopardy, please.
I watch Jeopardy and I'm self-conscious if I don't know the answer, so I'll act like I almost got it. I'll say like the end of the word as they say.
I knew that one.
Brady Bunch. Oh, yeah. No, they're not asking questions about the Brady Bunch. Maggie, this was fun. This is really, this is great. Thank you for being here with me
tonight. Oh, my God. And, honestly, anytime we can talk about things that are not politics, who isn't that nice? I do have to tell my very favorite show that has ever been on television.
Please.
And it is not for everybody, but I think The Wire is the best TV that was ever created.
I would say a lot of critics agree with you. That I've seen the whole show 2 times all the way through. I love it.
I bought it, the CD set, to have it. I was hooked the minute I watched the first episode. All right, and it's all about time and place. Oh, so good.
We will talk Wire next time you're here. That's fantastic.
I love it.
I love it too. Thanks. Have a great night. Good luck to your Brewers.
You too, guys. Stay safe out there.
All right. Thank you. That's Maggie Dawn. Check out her show, The Maggie Dawn Show, here on Civic Media every day. I'm very
from
excited.
2 to 4 p.m. too.
2 to 4 p.m. Yeah, there I should
we go.
Probably.
And we got it. We got
just surf. Just surf around. Don't make it too easy for him, Luke.
No, I want to make it easy for all the listeners. Easy for all the listeners.
Part 2 of my interview with John Davies is next on Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, coming to you live from Madison. Great to have you with me. It's funny, I was a Creedence Clearwater fan before I saw The Big Lebowski, but now I can't hear that song without thinking of the dude running his car into the dumpster, the Grand Torino, while he's looking for the joint in his lap. The music doesn't exist without The Big Lebowski anymore. It's crazy how a movie can do that. Welcome back. Very exciting night here. I have some great guests. We just had Maggie Dawn, and I'm about to bring in John Davies, a very successful producer who we talked to last week, and we're going to do part 2 in just a second. But first, I want to let people know that Nightlight with Pete Schwabba is sponsored by the Minocqua Brewing Company, who is making Wisconsin great again, one beer at a time. Check out their webpage, minocquabrewingcompany.com, to see where you can buy progressive beer and join them for live music, poetry, and progressive politics at their new tap room at 2927 East Washington Avenue in Madison. Great little spot to check out if you haven't already. Tomorrow night on the show, actress Kayla Kelly joins me, and Rob Thomas from the Capital Times will be here in studio, as I'll broadcast from Madison again tomorrow night, and it will be just as fun as tonight. But right now, I'm excited to welcome my next guest. He's a producer and a very successful one. He's originally from Chicago, living in L.A. now. We started talking last week. He makes these great documentaries. We talked about his documentary about the corruption in Illinois, Lincoln is Crying, last week, and we never got to the second documentary I wanted to kind of grill him about. called Funny Business. So he was nice enough to come back this week too. John Davies joins me now on Nightlight. Hey, John, welcome back.
Hey, thank you for having me back. Yeah, I was into that conversation. We got cut a little short by my wife's dinner plans.
That's okay. I hope it was a good dinner. Where'd you go?
Oh, just some local place here in Santa Barbara. I don't want to promote them. I didn't like it, to be honest.
Oh, dear. Yeah. Okay. You were, the whole time you were eating dinner, you're like, I could still be talking to Schwabe if things had turned out better.
About television. My favorite topic.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. So that was so much fun. Yeah. So let's get into, it was fun watching your documentary is Funny Business, P-H-U-N-N-Y Business. It was great to see so many familiar faces. And I'm going to tell you a quick story before we jump into that about one of the comics, Bernie Mac. I was on a cable show in Chicago with my friend, Steve Segrin. Steve was a pretty established comic at the time in Chicago. And he brought me along to this cable access show. And we were talking, one of the anchors from WGN was interviewing us, and Bernie Mac called, and he said, hey, Steve, they did call-ins on the show, and he said, hey, Steve, I was wondering if you'd want to open for me on the road. And Steve laughed, and he goes, you want me to open for you? And Bernie laughed, and Steve laughed, and I was like, who the heck is that guy? This was probably 94, John, and Bernie Mac was a huge star. And later I felt so stupid. I'm like, how did I not even know about this comedy club on the other side of town that was churning out big time stars? And I felt pretty ignorant. And it was really eye opening. But you made a documentary about this club, which I think was just great. Can you tell us a little bit about Funny Business?
Yeah, it came out of, I worked with Bob Zemuda on Comic Relief for about 8 years. And it was when I was first in LA. And by the way, I just want to throw this out real quickly. Bob and I right now are working on a sizzle reel for a doc called Comedy's Finest Hours, the story of Comic Relief. And because it's from the vault, the 20-year vault. That show was on from 86 to 2006. Wow. We're working on that. But while working with Bob, we traveled the country sometimes and did Comic Relief events, and we ended up doing an event at this club in Chicago called All Jokes Aside. We did it with Vanna White and Sinbad. Jeez. And we were giving away, Vanna White was working for Sealy Posturepedic Mattress Company, and she was giving away mattresses to underprivileged kids in her all-white fur coat. This was a black comedy club on the south side of Chicago, on South Wabash, actually. And I never forgot the club. I was blown away by it. And the guy who ran it, his name was Ray Lambert. And I ran into Ray on the streets of Chicago a few years later. And I said, hey, how's the club doing? And he said, oh, John, you don't want to hear. It's a long story, but it's gone.
Oh, man.
And I said, no, 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 I do want to hear that story. And this is after Bob and I had stopped working together. Not a falling out, just, 8 years was enough for both of us. And Ray told me the story about how the club ended, and I had been to it that night with Vanna White and Bob. Ray had shoved a pass in my hand and said, if you ever want to come in here, here's a pass. So I had gone back that very first night to see this whole other world of all black comedy with an all black audience. And I couldn't believe how well I was treated. And by the way, I was the butt of every joke, which was great. Yeah. You can take that thing where comedians come after you one of two ways. I looked at it, I would always bring dates. And for me, it worked. It was like, the date would go, how do they know you? I go, they don't know me. They just know I'm the white guy in the crowd.
Right.
And so I always looked at it as a very complimentary thing, and it was. So I listened to Ray's story, and I said, Ray, I know you're not going to believe me, but I'm going to make a film about this. I think it's that good. And he didn't believe me. Well, 2 years later, we had the film finished. I'd sold it to Showtime. We premiered it. It did really well. And the reason that club blew up is a little thing called Def Comedy Jam on HBO.
Yeah.
Because Ray's club beat that TV show by about 8 months to a year. Pretty soon that show opens. Everybody's watching it, especially Black America's like, wow, look at this. And then Ray had been booking those people into his little club for a couple of years at that point. And now all of a sudden, people could go, God, I can see all those people if I go to All Jokes Aside. So people were coming to All Jokes Aside to see these comedians that were only being discovered right then by a national audience. courtesy of HBO's Def Comedy Jam. And that show took off. You know, when HBO looked at the stats for that show, most of their audience was white because people wouldn't have gone to that neighborhood, but they were willing to watch it on TV, and they realized how damn funny these guys were and gals. And they were like, wow, this is a peek into a world we never even knew existed. And a lot of the white club owners would tell the black comedians, you know, don't do your black stuff tonight. Keep it broad. Jeez. Keep it general. But it, all jokes aside, they could do, they could cater to their audience, and they could do their black stuff, which, as it turns out, is really funny for white people too. You know, we wanted it too. And we didn't know that until Def Comedy Jam hit the air, and Americans saw it and went, this is great. So all those guys who had been, you know, touring through Ray's Club, and they had also been on what's called the Chitlin Circuit on the southern United States. There were other clubs like Ray's, not too many, but there were four or five of them that catered to all black audiences in different parts of the country. And so that's where black comedians could perform. The one club in town in Chicago that would put some black comedians on was called Zany's.
Sure.
But they would even tell the black comedians, you know, don't do that stuff that's real black, you know, right. Keep it broad. And because they knew their audience, and they thought they did, and they just didn't think stuff would play. But anyway, so I made this film about it, and people were thunderstruck, including a lot of my comedy friends, like my friends at Second City, from Jim Belushi to Tim Kazurinsky and all these guys that I knew at Second City. They were like, how come we never knew this club existed? Here we were doing comedy in Chicago, and we had no idea there was this hit factory just 8 or 9 miles to the south here.
That's exactly what I thought. We'll have more with John Davies coming up next on Night Light. Great stuff, John. Can't wait to get into more of that. That's up next on the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back. Favorite card game. That's what we're asking people tonight. What is your favorite card game? From the 818, Bridget says, Uno. Great for the whole family. And Slapjack. That's a game I haven't heard of in a while.
That's a throwback right there.
Yeah, you know that one?
Oh, yeah.
So that's a Wisconsin game, too, apparently, maybe.
Really?
I don't know.
I never heard of it. Wisconsin Cousins and I used to play it. That would be the one where go back to your parents and you'd be like, why is your hand so red? And I'd be like, Johnny got me real good in Slapjack. That's what that reminds me of.
Slapjack again. Very excited to, I've already welcomed my next guest to continue the conversation with John Davies. He's a producer who just does great work. And we're talking about his documentary Funny Business right now. John, before the break, you talked about, you know, when you would talk to your Second City friends and that nobody knew about this club. Before I get into your actual filmmaking and style, which I'm a big fan of, what happened to the club? I mean, you kind of go there in the documentary, you say it just, they went bankrupt. Was it a gradual thing? I know you made reference to theaters kind of selling out comics and they became competition, but it seemed to happen quickly.
Well, there were two main things that sort of began the end of the club. One was they got really, really successful, as did all the people, all the performers who were in it. And they were being offered bigger venues when they came to Chicago. Like, you know, then they were putting two and two together and going, you know, I can make X, which was guaranteed by the management of all jokes aside, because they never didn't pay people. Right. They always paid what they agreed upon. That's why the comedians loved them. But they're being offered two nights at the Chicago Theater, all the seats devoted to them, going, you know, we can't really afford to do this anymore. You know, perform down the street at Ray's Little Club. So that was one of the factors. And the other factor was that as it got more successful, some white people did start coming into it. And Ray correctly postulated that if he moved the club across the Chicago River to the north side of town, he could get that whole white entertainment in the white entertainment district. He could get all those people to come into his club, and he could open up a slightly bigger venue and do even better. So he went up there to do that. He rented space. He started building it out. And then the word got around to all the surrounding businesses that, hey, this black club's moving in here. And they did what one of the techniques in Chicago, if you want to kill something like that, you slow down the liquor license.
Right.
And without the liquor license, Ray would go under. So he, you know, he went to the alderman in that area. I don't want to say the guy's name right now, but he went to him and he got the runaround. And what Ray wouldn't do, which you know, because you worked in Chicago, you know Chicago a little bit, Ray wouldn't play the game, which is you got to pull out your wallet and you got to pay people. You've got to start paying people. And Ray's big fear was, even though white guys get away with that all the time, he was afraid that that would be used against him, that he'd be the one guy they wouldn't take the money from. They'd turn him in and convict him. So he didn't pay people. Well, there's other ways to get that done. I mean, I kept thinking like, Ray, there's workarounds for that. It doesn't have to go through you. Me thinking in my typically Chicago corrupt manner. But Ray said, John, you're not a black businessman in Chicago. You don't know what the risk was for me. So they held up his liquor license so long, he went broke. I mean, he was building this club out. He was putting in all this plumbing. But also, and he admits this in the film, also, the marketplace was changing. As I said, these comedians could go sell out the Chicago theater and make 10 times what Ray could pay them because now they were big stars because of Def Comedy Jam.
Right.
So that happened. The combination of those two things was the 1-2 punch that killed all jokes aside. Now, a lot of these comedians said, oh, Ray, why don't you just stay in your neighborhood? But Ray was a dreamer. He was a businessman, too. He had an MBA. He was trained to keep growing, growth. It's growth is kind of an American disease that might one day be our downfall, but everybody's into it. As soon as you get successful in this country, they want to see, well, what's your growth plan for next year? Is it going to be 10%, 15%? For some reason, nobody in the world's ever happy with just, you know, zero growth and just sustain. You know, I'm a big fan of that. Everybody has to, you have to keep showing your stockholders 20% growth or they get rid of it. But anyway, that's what happened to Ray. And so, you know, a lot of people were upset with him because he did take some loans to build that place out and then it never opened. So for about 10 years, Ray disappeared and, you know, went into sort of a depression. He even talked about, you know, maybe partnering with Second City and opening a club. I mean, he tried a lot of different things, but none of it really panned out. And by the time I discovered him, he was basically out of the comedy business. But he fortunately had hung on to some tape. He fortunately had that great story he told me. And by that time, I was a connected enough producer that I could pull a show like that off.
Jeez, that is an incredible story. And he's producing films now. If I kind of Googled him after I watched your film. Seems like he was doing more like film work or trying to anyway.
Well, he's working with Kartemquin, you know?
Oh, yeah.
They love minority filmmakers because it ups their chances of getting grants.
Right.
So they've taken Ray in, and I don't know what he's done there, but he's done a few films with them. I don't think he's making much doing that. You know, there's a difference between making documentaries and making money doing documentaries.
Yeah.
I've always, because I was sort of trained in TV first, you know, I don't do docs that don't make me something, you know, although I have to say the Ray doc I did totally as a flyer. We didn't make much on that. I did that because I was itching to do a documentary and I just thought the topic was so good. And by that time I had enough connections in Hollywood that I could pull that off. And what I mean by that is I had a really powerful manager and who all the managers of all those black comedians were impressed by my manager. And so when he kind of announced that my client John Davies is doing this film, people left me alone. Nobody came after me. Nobody tried to, you know, hold me up for tons of money.
Right.
We did that all on a favored nations basis. And my manager is a guy named Sandy Wernick. You know, one of his other clients is Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
So everybody leaves Sandy alone. I always say, I always love putting Sandy's name on all my films. And I always liken it to that sign that people put in their house, beware of attack dog. You don't want to piss Sandy Wernick off, you know?
Right.
You want him. And so he had also, he was one of the EPs of Def Comedy Jam with Russell Simmons and Stan Lathan. And so, you know, I knew those guys really well because I had worked with them. So I had all the right credentials to do that. I was probably one of the only white guys in LA that could have pulled that film off. And I'm not saying that to brag. I just happened to have the right set of credentials.
Well, you did a great job. It's interesting. Documentary filmmakers need to build trust with their subjects and get them to talk. And they all have different methods on how they do that. I've talked to a ton of documentary filmmakers over the years. You have, you know, I don't want to say, was that easier for you because they're comedians? They all seem like they couldn't wait to talk. Like they were all so personable because they're comics and they want to entertain. And that's how a lot of the interviews seem to me. You must have thought you struck gold as a filmmaker.
Well, there were three things that worked there. Either I knew them, Ray definitely knew them. And what really paid off for Ray was he had been so scrupulously honest paying these guys. Like they had been screwed at so many other clubs where, right. Hey, I know it's full tonight, but half of these we gave away and they comped them. Right. We don't really have that $3,000 we promised you. And they were so used to being screwed. And Raymond, because he was an MBA and a business guy, if you signed a deal with Ray, he was good for it. Even if nobody showed up, you were going to get paid. They all remembered how well they were treated by Ray. So when he called in this favor, they were like, we'll be there.
Oh, that's so
only
cool.
One or two people said no, and I'm not going to mention who they are because I don't want to damage their relationship. But if I told you the names, you would go, oh, yeah, I get it. But only one or two people said no. I knew a few of them, and then others I knew through either Russell Simmons, Sandy Wernick, or Stan Lathan, the three Def Jam executives. I would get them to help. But you know what we did? We were really lucky. We just waited in our editing room and we would open up the paper every week or the reader and would say, hey, Bernie Mac's coming into town next week, or hey, Cedric's coming into town next week. So we didn't have to go traveling anywhere. We just waited until the comedian came through town.
That's so great.
We had a backdrop. We'd say, hey, come on by our editing suite. And they would. And they would all sit and talk about it. And you are correct. It's great to interview comedians. Because, hey, it's a camera, right? And what do they want to talk about? Themselves. Right. Do they want to score? You bet they want to score. They want to be funny. One of my favorite moments in funny business is we asked everybody the same question about how do you handle hecklers, right?
Yeah.
When we got to AJ Jamal, who I had worked with before, so he knew me. When we got to AJ Jamal, I loved his take on how we handled that. I said, so AJ, tell me what your method is for handling hecklers. And he went, I've never had a heckler because I'm funny. Oh. And then he went, ha, ha, I bet you everybody else told you their story. He did that to screw with everybody else. You know what I mean?
That's funny.
He never had a heckler. Of course he had.
Of course he. Although he's so high energy, people didn't have time to heckle AJ Jamal because he was always so moving.
I think he's one of the most underrated comics I ever saw. I thought AJ Jamal was fantastic. What a physical comedian. I love his story about how we used to do Michael Jackson and do the splits. I have to say, by the time I interviewed AJ Jamal, I could tell he was going to need hip surgery. He was so physical. He had done so many of those splits things in his act. But by the time I interviewed him for this film, he was limping. I mean, he had a cane, I think.
Oh, wow.
He had physically damaged himself, but he was still all there. Mentally, he was still really funny. And I loved him. I don't know why his career didn't take off. He made a good living. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. He just never exploded, you know?
How did you strike a chord? Like, you got all these funny guys in this documentary. Was there pressure for you to make a funny film, or did you just let the guys talk? Because tonally, it really moves. And your Lincoln Is Crying did as well, John. You had a great pace to it. And, you know, even if your style is such that even if someone isn't 100% locked into the subject, they're going to be entertained because of the direction. Was there any pressure to direct comedians or to make it funny, even though they're being funny?
Well, you know, Raymond would always discourage me and go, John, you shouldn't try and be as funny as the comedians. And I'm like, Ray, I'm not going to be as funny as the comedians, but I've been making films and I've been making comedy shows and specials for a decade at that point. I'm not worried about making a special funny. I know how to do that. I don't need them to provide all the comedy. I can do some of that with just how I cut it,
right.
How I juxtapose one comedian against another. I don't pretend that I'm a joke writer. If I really need comedy written, I usually work with my friend Eddie Feldman, five-time Emmy-winning comedy writer who's written for almost every comedian, former stand-up himself. Like if I were to say, get Conan to be the narrator of this comic relief film I want to do now, he would need to know that there was a real comedy writer on that for him. He wouldn't accept me.
Okay, right, okay.
I haven't won 5 Emmys as a comedy writer, but I'm not afraid to be humorous in the telling of a story. I've been doing that for years.
Right.
And I know how to. So I kept saying to Ray, you're nervous about that. I'm not. You wait and see, Ray. This film is going to be funny overall, even the sections when the comedians aren't on camera. And it's true, because about 3 or 4 years ago, the Pasadena Public Library called me and said, can we show this film during Black History Month, which is February? And me and the editor went, and we stood outside the library, which probably had at least 300 Black people in the library watching the film, and we just listened to the gales of laughter come out of the windows. Now a lot of that was the comedians, but it was also in between the comedians. It was all the stuff that Brian and I put in there that was funny. So I was never intimidated by that. I get asked that question a lot. No, I've worked around comedy people my whole life. I wrote stuff for Jim Belushi and Rob Reilly and Kazurinsky, and they all trust me, you know, but I'm not a joke writer.
Yeah.
I don't do what Judd Apatow. I mean, I love how Judd Apatow sometimes says, oh, you want to write a joke? And then he writes a joke and it's good, you know?
Right.
I didn't have that kind of training, but I was writing for Second City people for my short films for years. So by the time I got to this crowd of Ray, Ray's a businessman. I know why he doesn't want to compete with comedians, right. But I don't feel that I'm light years away from them. I feel I have a little more in common with them.
Yeah. It's funny what you said about club owners not paying people. I remember, and this was a white club owner, and a guy went in to get paid at the end of the week, and the club was about to close. He had no money, and he was screwing people over, and he hands them $500 in cash, and he goes, don't spend this till Thursday. Like, that's how broke he was. Well, have a couple more minutes with John Davies on Nightlight. We'll be right back. This is Pete Schwab on the Civic Media Radio Network. From the 608, Aunt Carla says, Euchre, getting late into questions. Storms are here in Baraboo. I believe Conrad is in Greece. We'll keep tabs on the K-Man. He's probably safer there than we are here in Wisconsin. Terrible weather, folks. Keep an eye on it and get somewhere safe because it is ugly out there. My guest, we got a few more minutes here with John Davies, the producer. We're talking about his documentary, Funny Business, about a black comedy club. The first black-owned comedy club that was located in the South Loop in Chicago. John, you split time, and you talk about your next project being the comic relief. Where do you feel more, inspired, Chicago or L.A., or does it matter?
It doesn't matter to me, really. It I do have a deep love of Chicago, and I look back at my films and I would say 70% of them have a Chicago theme. I mean, Bob Zmuda of Comic Relief, where's he from? Northwest side of Chicago. Why did he and I hit it off? We're both Chicago guys. I mean,
yeah.
I know that was part of the chemistry between us. So Chicago's had a big impact on me. It's the first time I, you know, really went to see comedy as a kid. It's just living outside of the city and going downtown was a big deal. And, you know, my dad would lunch at some of these famous clubs, like I'm trying to remember now what Gibson's used to be called. It was a famous, famous comedy club. It's escaping me right now.
Yeah. But
my dad would go there and he would tell me about the comedians. He saw Woody Allen there one night. He saw Dick Cavett there.
Wow.
The Playboy Club was there
in
Chicago. I was definitely influenced by it. And I always kind of wanted to be, you know, be known in Chicago for something. But you've made me realize something, that a lot of my work is it's all comedy disguised as something else. I created a magazine, a weekly magazine show on Wild on WTTW called Wild Chicago.
Oh yeah,
it's a magazine show, but it's really a comedy show masquerading as a a weekly informative magazine.
Nice.
Because it wasn't really an informative magazine. It was a comedy show. And a lot of my, the thing I just finished a few years ago, Lincoln is Crying, is a comedy doc.
Yeah.
Masquerading as a look at the political history of Chicago. But you look at who's narrating it, David Pasquazi from Second City, Kazurinsky's in it, Mike Haggerty from Second City. You know, that's cut to be comedic too.
Right.
So I just realized that I got that comedy bug early and I haven't been able to leave it. I haven't sold this comedy's greatest, finest hours doc yet. I've just been approached by Zamuda and his family about getting it done because Bob is in charge of the world's greatest comedy vault. That 20 hours of comic relief, that vault has everybody.
You have to do something. It's like, that's too great.
Yeah, I kind of have to. And I probably produced about 25% of what's in that vault with Bob. The other 75% was done by other people, a lot of them before I got there. But I did about 25% of it. And I know that vault really well. It is a treasure trove. I mean, I was looking at footage the other day. Can I just tell you this story real quick?
Yeah.
Comic Relief 1 was 1986. Harold Ramis was supposed to be a big part of Comic Relief, like on the board. And I found backstage footage of Harold Ramis in a big argument with the head of HBO at the time, who was Chris Albrecht. And then he never showed up in any more Comic Reliefs. And I remember Bob saying, oh yeah, we had a falling out with him. Well, I want to know what that was.
Yeah, right.
How do you have a falling out with one of the genius comedy directors of all time? Now, they were able to pull off Comic Relief without Harold Ramis because they had 100 other comics to go to.
Right.
But I just think I want to tell all these stories because that place was a hotbed of competition. I remember one of the things I witnessed was how Gary Shandling, every time they did Comic Relief, he would have some excuse or reason why he had to open the show. But the real reason was there was always some big event that had just happened, like the LA riots or hurricane or storms or fires or police beatings. He wanted to get all his material done first. Right. And you'd see all the other comedians standing backstage crossing stuff off, like, well, now I can't do that because Gary's done it. But he'd always have some excuse. And he had the power because he had the Larry Sanders Show on HBO. And he could always sort of weasel his way into being the opening comic. So that Comic Relief doc, I really pray that Bob and I can sell that. I think we can. And I can't wait to be standing here 2 years from now with that one done.
That would be fun.
Comedy's Finest Hours is what we're going to call it. And one other quick thing, can I just tell you real quick?
Yeah.
Your other guest who was on, she was talking about the housewives and all that.
Yeah.
When I first arrived in LA, I was working at Hearst Entertainment. And one of the companies that Hearst co-owned was a company called Trio in New York. And they were a super arty basic cable entity. And who was the main buyer at Trio? Andy Cohen. So I would fly to New York and pitch him. And he was wildly entertaining. I mean, I would always tell my boss, Jerry Abrams, like, this guy, Andy Cohen, he's amazing. I mean, he should be on TV. Well, I had no idea that was his goal. He had wanted to be on TV. He had been on all those morning shows as a producer, trying to get them to put him on. And then he ended up becoming kind of a big way to get a Trio, which was a very arty channel. It was kind of what arts and entertainment was supposed to be, but wasn't.
Yeah.
And Andy wasn't on Trio. Andy wasn't an executive at Trio for long before he got them to do a pilot with him. And man, is he taken off.
No,
he is Bill Bravo.
That's fantastic. John, we got about 30 seconds left. Can you give me a TV show recommendation, something you're watching that I can share with listeners?
A TV show recommendation? What do I watch a ton of right now? Man, you've got me on the spot here. I'm 70, so I've suddenly had this mental moment. Just give me a few more seconds. What am I watching? Well, here's my guilty pleasure, and I'm not alone, and every writer guy I know in L.A., I am a Dateline fanatic.
Oh, wow.
I watch everything that Keith Morrison does. I love Keith Morrison. One day I was in L.A., and I met one of the guys who edits Keith Morrison's Dateline pieces, and I said to him, you have no idea what a fan base you have. He goes, oh, I have every idea. Yes, there's not a single screenwriter in LA that hasn't told me this already.
That's great.
Like, I went to lunch with this guy, Keith Morrison and Dateline. And it turns out, who has he been the stepfather to for years? Matthew Perry.
Oh, I heard that. That's right. John, we got to go. Thank you so much for your time and for coming back again. This is great. And I really hope we do get another chance to talk after your next project or before that. That would be great.
Thanks for having me on. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
You bet. We'll talk soon. I got a lot of stories for you, by the way. All right. That's John Davies joining us here tonight on Nightlight. We'll be back tomorrow night. Thank you to my guest, Maggie Dawn, John Davies. Thank you for all your texts. It's awful. Thank you, Luke Mathers.
Always a pleasure, Pete.
Always fun. We'll see you tomorrow night for more Nightlight. Good night, Wisconsin.